So I'm going to call the public hearing to order, convene the Committee on Public Safety, Ways and Means, open the public hearing on 5509, which is the Department of Corrections budget. This is continued on. First off on the list, I have the group from Marion County, Roel Ramirez, Dale Penn, and Mike Ryan. Gentlemen, you'll come forward.
Good afternoon, Chairman Patridge and members of the Public Safety Subcommittee. My name is Mike Wilkerson. I'm the Undersheriff for Marion County Sheriff's Office. On behalf of Sheriff Ramirez, I'm appearing, who's unable to be here probably before the end of the testimony. I'll probably wish he was here, but anyway, I'm filling in for him today. So, to my left is Commissioner Mike Ryan, and to his left is District Attorney Dale Penn. So we'll be here to make a brief presentation on behalf of Marion County today and answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Walters.
Marion County is one of 10 counties in the state where community corrections is under the responsibility of the sheriff. You have already heard testimony from several sheriffs expressing concern over the broken promises from the state about funding community corrections programs at the baseline level and the reason for the opt-out clause in the 1145 rule if funding was not provided at this level. The sheriffs also shared with you the reasons they submitted legislation to repeal the partnership agreement. You've also heard testimony from the community corrections directors about what works or best practices, which have dealt with the following. It talked a little bit about holding offenders accountable, providing a range of sanctions and treatment services to offenders, focusing resources on the highest risk offenders, and lastly, targeting treatment interventions on crime-related risk. Marion County certainly supports the points made by both the community corrections directors and the sheriffs. Marion County began full participation in the Community Corrections Act in 1979. Two primary reasons the county got involved in community corrections back in 79. The first was that the current practice of county supervising misdemeanors as well as the state supervising felony offenders was highly dysfunctional. And the second reason was Marion County was more in touch with addressing the needs of the local community. So that's the primary two reasons where we opted to go into the community corrections in 79. So for the past 24 years, Marion County has fully participated in the community corrections program. Because of the lack of adequate funding, which is faced with you today, the $40 million statewide, that equates to about $3.3 million to Marion County, which breaks down basically to going from 528 jail beds to approximately 255 jail beds and eliminating most of the programs that we're currently offering. So that's one option you can certainly look at is the funding issue. And the other option that we're recommending that you look at is certainly reducing the workload expectations, similar to what the health plan is doing at the present time. It's Marion County's intentions to opt out of the Community Corrections Program, which unfortunately I believe has a proven track record at this time. This decision will truly set Community Corrections Programs back to where it started in Marion County 24 years ago. So thank you for your time. And
thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Dale Penn. I'm Marion County District Attorney. The reason I'm here is just I think that the issue of 1145 is important. You've heard a lot of testimony about it. I was part of the work group that probably 50 individuals on this work group when it was set up almost 8 years ago. And one of the things that's unique about it is this opt-out clause. I don't know of any other partnership situation that has an opt-out clause. And the reason it was there is that there were many people 8 years ago who simply didn't trust the state. And they said, you know, we've had promises and we know the governor's saying that they're going to give this money in the next budget and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, but we just don't believe it. It's happened too many times in the past. And so this unique provision of opt-out was put there to say the state means it and we mean it enough to say that if we break our promise, you can walk away. So that's why it's there. Now, I know that Marion County does not wish to opt out. I think that's clear in the letter that's presented. It's just that we find ourselves, and I think Commissioner Ryan can address this a little very focused manner here about our entire system, but we find ourselves in a situation where we simply cannot backfill. We're having to cut programs. We had to cut 65 positions last year in our budget, and public safety is a big portion of our budget, and so we can't put new money to backfill public safety programs. If we're able to just maintain, we would be happy this year. So we're kind of caught. I believe in looking at the entire criminal justice system that one of the holes in the system is parole and probation. And I think this subcommittee, just by your ranking, has identified that as a hole. The whole budget process in the last couple of years created a $40 million plus cut to parole and probation, and I think you've put it on your ranking list. Forget exactly where it's at, but a $30 million hole for community corrections. And I think that is accurate. We're in a situation where we've had to close our work center. We've had to cut back in what we can do to hold offenders accountable. We have too many offenders for the amount of jail space that we have. And so most offenders are not housed in the jail. And we don't have the enforcement capabilities we would have. We need, really, to provide motivation to offenders not to reoffend. So that's the problem in the system now. We don't have dollars to build up that system, and when the state pulls back the underpinnings of parole and probation, that's when we get faced with this dilemma of having to opt out if that's where we end up. So I think with that explanation, we want to bring that for you because we believe that as you leave this building with a balanced budget, we believe that community corrections has to be built up in some way, just as your prioritization chart has shown, or else the system isn't going to operate. And so with that, I'll ask Commissioner Ryan to speak.
Thank you, Dale. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mike Ryan. I'm a Marion County Commissioner. And I just want to spend a couple of minutes just talking about where we find ourselves in Marion County and from the board's perspective as well. As Dale mentioned, you know, we have taken the formal step to notify the Department of Corrections of our intent to take advantage of or exercise the opt-out in the community partnership. But one of the reasons I wanted to come to share some thoughts with you today is we didn't do this lightly. We didn't do it without an awful lot of discussion, deliberations. We did it really with clenched teeth, quite honestly. And it certainly isn't our first choice in any way or the best choice. And I think we clearly recognize that as well as I know you do as well. Just to emphasize where we are budgetarily, and I can't speak on behalf of all of the counties, but I'll just focus on Marion County's budget picture. I met this morning in advance of this with our budget team for a few minutes just to get an idea of where we are and what our future looks like, and also to reflect a little bit about where we've been. And in Marion County, we've been tightening our budget for a number of years. It hasn't, you know, happened overnight for us. The current fiscal year we're operating currently, we cut about $5.5 million out of our general fund, and those are real cuts and real reductions. And proportionally across counties, we could have a little bit of a difference on how you account for general fund, but generally, in Marion County, our general fund is about 60% spent on public safety. And I don't think that would be that far out of line with other counties, depending on what dollars you put in there. But it is certainly the lion's share of the top priority of Marion County and the other counties. That 60% is one that we believe is in keeping with our mission, our top priorities for our spending. But as well, when we take cuts, because it's such a lion's share, the public safety also takes a lion's share of the reductions. And as the district attorney mentioned, we've made some really tough decisions along the way. A couple of years ago, we were operating a 144-bed work-release center, and as of February of this year, it was closed in its entirety. That is an option that is just not available in our community at all relative to sanctioning. We also in our community have taken a real active role with our LPSync, our Local Public Safety Coordinating Council that we all have, and we have taken a great deal of time working with our community in all 20 of our cities, addressing from a comprehensive analysis and research basis where is our criminal justice system in Marion County. And we went through this quite lengthy and arduous process, and we actually produced a report to our community last year. And the title for that is not a dramatization of our circumstance. I think it's just a depiction of where we are, and it's Marion County Criminal Justice System, a system in crisis. And that's our analysis of where we are, and that's what we face in our community. We went as far as to attempt anyway to present this information to the voters of Marion County. We did so last November in a comprehensive way against a systems approach, and unfortunately we were not successful. The voters rejected that 54 to 46. In sum, we've really been working. We've been working mightily. We've been working to be innovative, to cut costs, to look to community partnerships, to look to the faith community, to look to others to really embrace the problems that we face. We have found ourselves in the position that additional reductions in state funding in the Community Corrections Partnership cannot be backfilled by Marion County out of our general fund. It is something that we just cannot do. Our current general fund contribution, we do make a contribution, as the other counties do, into Community Corrections, can really be looked at as our sort of cash match relative to the state's participation here. And if, in fact, this opt-out were to be moved to its total implementation, that opt-out cash contribution also would be something that would be subject to loss relative to operating these programs in our communities as well. So it's really a compounding effect as well. The last is, we certainly don't envy what's on your plate or the decisions that are before you at all. And the reason that we're here today is not to present an image in any way of any kind of confrontation, but really from the standpoint of we've been partners for 24 years in this. And we believe that working in partnership, we have created an effective, efficient, and cost-effective system that, in fact, is a model of best practices. It gets the job done as far as that approach in local control. And so we find ourselves in the conundrum, this difficult decision-making process. And we're suggesting that, we really have three considerations in this partnership. The first is, no matter how difficult it is, how trying it may be, or what the options may be, is to locate and fund the community corrections at that $40 million level and continue this community partnership. The second option is to change and alter the workload requirements for supervision of offenders in our community. And the third is to find out and to figure out how the state can step to the plate and take this challenge on when we can't. Those are not really fun options, and we recognize that. From our perspectives, option number one and option number two appear to be the best of the most unfortunate, options before us. We're just here to, underline our continued hope for partnership, but certainly recognize the difficulties that we all face together in that partnership way. So I appreciate as well you extending the opportunity for at least our team to come back today and provide your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I talked to Dale real briefly yesterday, and I think you all contacted by Ginger Martin from the Department of Correction. Is that she correct? Or?
Go ahead.
She did call me this morning.
I guess my concern, unfortunately, you guys were after Department of Corrections presented some of their facts and figures regarding recidivism rates. Statewide, and Marion County happens to be one of the counties that the recidivism rate is rising on probation as opposed to, I mean, there's kind of been some ups and downs, but you've continued kind of to rise as to kind of the effectiveness, really, of your probation program. And I'm trying to get my arms around, from your perspective, why you think that may be happening, or two, how should we deal with that as a state legislature in terms of trying to evaluate programs and what process we may want to subject counties to, involve counties with, however you want to say it.
Well, let me just take a kind of a first initial response to it, and then I'm going to turn it over to District Attorney Dale Penn.
There may be another lateral there.
I let Dale know last night
at
5 o'clock. He didn't let you know.
Yeah, he let me know this morning.
All right.
I did have some conversation with Ginger this morning, and yes, we do receive what I would consider a report card on a fairly regular basis, and we are sensitive, and we take the information fairly serious. As you didn't mention was is that on the post-prison and parole, we are below the statewide average on those particular statistics, and those of which we deal with, because we are supervisory authority, we do have more direct control over those particular offenders. On the probationers, again, using the terminology, 3 years of, I think they track felony convictions when they're on supervision, is how they're defining recidivism. Those particular cases really, I think, are a couple of different issues there that we need to consider. One of those for probation cases, they are under supervision, but they are responsible to the court under probation. In our particular county, our judges take a very active role in what those offenders do, and they don't allow as many alternative sanctions. When, in fact, a person is charged with a new felony offender, the courts want to see them. And the courts then, through the district attorney's office, make some of those decisions. Where parole and probation does get involved is what do you do before they commit a new crime? And what kind of programs do you have available to go ahead and sanction them? And as you heard earlier, the sanctioning resources are drying up in Marion County. We have gone from 672 beds to down to 528 beds over the last 3 years. So that, as a sanction itself, as you probably have heard before, without an empty jail bed, it certainly doesn't provide the deterrence that you hope it would. And you can offer the particular programs there, too, but in the event that they don't successfully complete the programs, you need some other options available for them, and the offenders know that. So I'm going to kind of lateral it to Dale for his responses as well.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. No, and this subcommittee has heard me talk about the system as a whole in the past, and you've heard me say that from my analysis, I believe it's very important, and the primary function of the state system is to incarcerate in a penitentiary model violent offenders and repeat property offenders. Because, and you have to maintain that, because the local law enforcement agencies and criminal justice system has really lost the capability to have much control over offenders. Because of this shrinking resource at the local level. And that reduction from 650 to 528 or whatever those numbers was, that was horrendous for holding probationers accountable. Now, if somebody's going to go out and commit new felony crimes, we want to have them held accountable for that. So we aren't going to kick it under the rug. They should be held accountable. That should be documented. But what do you do with that person? As you know, with present sentencing rules, unless they get to a certain number of these lower property crimes, they can't go to prison. And I'll keep residential burglary out of this, but stealing cars and all this other stuff and drugs, that offender's just going to keep rattling around in the local system. And that's what we see in our county. And one of the reasons we believe these dollars are so important, because they help us fund some of the sanctions that we have left. Right now, we probably have about a 35 to 40% failure to appear rate. Now, I haven't seen these charts, so I don't know all the counties that are involved, but I heard last night that Lane County was one of them, and Marion County was one of them, and I heard that Multnomah County was one of them. And lo and behold, that's the three biggest counties as far as crime rates and sending people to prison and problem offenders. And our county and Multnomah County, the two biggest draws of pulling people from the state systems into your county as residences. We have a lot of complicators here about recidivism. But our situation is simply with that high of a failure to appear rate, we have people who go out, they'll be on probation, they will abscond, they will get arrested on a new crime, and unless it's a crime of violence, they are going to be released or they're going to be given a citation and then they aren't going to appear, and they're just going to keep wandering around our community until you have to have at least four failure to appears on the same crime before we're going to be able to hold you in our jail. And we probably aren't going to be able to keep that anymore, given the population that we have in the jail. So we have a major, major problem. If you opened up the pages of the Statesman Journal today, you would read about a guy who got sent to prison. Okay. Now, what they really focused there on was the fact, well, he didn't have a lawyer, and so that's why he'd been kind of sitting around. That wasn't really what started this. He was stealing cars. And so he predated the indigent defense problem. He was stealing cars, and he wouldn't show up. And he would go out and steal a car and get caught by the car dealers and get arrested and be immediately released and fail to appear. We couldn't hold him, and we couldn't do anything with him. Then the indigent defense thing made it more complicated. But he did have a probation matter on a Berg 1, and he will show up in those stats now as a failure because he got sent to prison today. But he'd done five stolen cars in the last couple of months, and he's totally out of control. Now, I will say, in the reading the articles, the last one, he said, you know, I'm tired of doing this. I want to change my life around. And he did come in and plead guilty in court and accept some punishment and say, I don't want to stay here anymore. I hope that turns him around. That's why I think preserving the prison capability for these people is very important. But there has to be community resources as well. And ours have shrunk. And our ability to hold people accountable is very minimal. And I expect that is a major reason why those stats show what they show. But I also don't want to change focus away from personal responsibility. These people are making a choice. They understand, believe me, they understand the system is not able to hold them accountable. And so they will keep going around. That's what this guy said. Until finally he got held and he says, you know, this has gotten out of control. I need to change my life. But up until then, I thought this was lots of fun. They couldn't do anything to me. So that's the problem. And it is just a real quick analysis of the problem you face as a budget panel trying to make sure this system works when we get all done. And that's why we think community corrections has to be part of the working solution.
But I guess my concern is Marion County's gotten the same amount per person as every other county since 19, and you guys haven't seen these, so maybe we can have an offline conversation about it. But my concern is that Lipsticks are really looking at these types of trend analysis, which I think is important, and that really the state needs to look at these trend analyses to see who's doing it right, because there's a lot of other counties who are getting the same amount of money, and not to beat up on you guys, and we all have unique circumstances, but I mean, just that's a concern of the chair, obviously, and I'm trying to figure out how to wrap my arms around it in light of arguing for more money for 1145 to be able to say, well, it's been effective and working. So,
and Mr. Chair, I can simply just respond real quickly. I think that's important, and certainly we're willing to work on that and look at that as well. I do think that every county comes to the table in a different situation. And that was the problem back with 1145. Multnomah County was in an absolute terrible crisis. And 1145 helped them build some jail space, but it didn't solve the problem.
They were already drowning before you gave them the 1145 people. 1145 brought some resources, and so it helped a little bit, but you gave you more people as well. And so every county was in a different situation at the time, and no one got to the point where they say, hey, we have an empty bed for an offender if they choose not to comply with probation. That's the problem. We've always been behind the curve. But your point about it, this system needs to be accountable, and we need to try to spend our money wisely, that's a good point, and I think everyone is prepared to work in that area.
Representative Hanson.
Two questions. Commissioner Ryan,
yes.
You mentioned there was a $5 million decrease in your budget in real dollars. What's driving that revenue problem in Marion County?
Well, I don't know how dissimilar it would be to other counties as well. I mean, we're looking at a situation where, you know, our revenue picture is capped at a 3%, and we have our costs that are locked in as well, like other counties. What we're attempting to do is to really build a new base relative to our entire operations so that we're in equilibrium. And as a result of that, this current fiscal year, we really took a pretty heady slice out of our spending to bring that equilibrium back in. But I really, from my perspective in working and talking with other counties, I really don't know how dissimilar we really are in facing the economic, you know, problems that we have. We're adjusting, and we have so far. And, you know, as we're looking at our revenue future here, and again, I met with the budget folks today, you know, because of the action that we have taken, we're still going to be in a position where we're going to take additional reductions in our general fund two fiscal years from now when all of the PERS implications really hit us. Our bottom line goes red pretty dramatically. So even with our projections now with what we know and what we believe to be the case relative to PERS, we're still looking at really substantial reductions two fiscal years from now.
Follow-up question for
Representative Hanson.
For Mr. Penn. On that case you were talking about, did you check how he got to court that last time?
He was, Mr.
You don't have to answer that.
Okay. I hope it wasn't a BMW.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much
for being here. Just for the record, the chair is going to accept Bernie Giusto, the Multnomah County Sheriff's written testimony. He couldn't be here today, and John Powell, who represents the Sheriff's Association, is here today and submitted that for him. So thank you, John. And so that's been passed out to the committee members. Tony Hyde and Kristen Kirk.
Kristen was the one from Multnomah County. She couldn't be here.
Okay, so we're passing those people over. Arwen Bird, Victoria Heck, and Chip Shields.
Begin. Good afternoon. My name is Arwen Bird. I'm the Executive Director of Survivors Advocating for an Effective System. We're a member-driven organization of crime survivors, and the perspective that we bring is that of restorative justice. Essentially, restorative justice seeks to look at the system in terms of what harm is done. In a restorative system, victims and offenders and communities are the focus of kind of when crime happens. Those are the three areas where primarily harm is done. And a restorative system would ultimately work to repair the damage. I'm also a violent crime survivor in that I was paralyzed by a drunk driver. So have personal experience with crime and am obviously very personally interested in this issue. Essentially, I'm here today to represent our organization. We're also a member of the Oregon Criminal Justice Reform Coalition. And I want to talk to you a bit about a couple of issues that we're concerned about in terms of the Department of Corrections budget. We all want safe, livable communities. I think that's something that we could all generally agree on. It's just a matter of how we get to those safe, livable communities that becomes a question. For us as crime survivors, we see the programming inside prisons as being part of that key safe, livable community, that we need to provide programs so that when people return back to society, that they are able to become engaged, productive members of their society rather than re-victimizing people and perpetuating that cycle of violence. I can't emphasize enough how important education programs and treatment programs are for people inside prisons. As a crime survivor, I want to know that my government is doing everything it can to ensure that what happened to me will not happen to somebody else. And part of the way we do that is by providing quality programs to people while they're incarcerated. Other two issues that I'd like to talk about, in this time of fiscal crisis, obviously, I've just listened to a round of testimony about how these budget cuts are going to affect very directly programs in our communities. The Oregon Criminal Justice Reform Coalition has brought forward some proposals that will present cost savings for you that can also ensure public safety. One of the proposals that we've brought forward and that our organization is strongly supportive of is the notion of earn time, that you would expand the numbers of offenders that had access to earn time through the Department of Corrections system. Research from the Department of Corrections has shown that people who have access up to 20% earn time off of their sentence have lower recidivism rates. It's an incentive. It's pretty simple logic for us as crime survivors that we would be able to provide this incentive, especially if the cost savings that you get from earn time could be used to enhance the educational and treatment programs that you're providing inside prisons. Very much part of those safe, livable communities that we're all working toward. The last thing that I want to bring up in my testimony is an issue that is very difficult for us to discuss because it's a bit of a touchy subject, and that's Measure 11. The truth is that nobody wants to talk about mandatory sentencing, but the fact of the matter is that mandatory sentencing has driven the cost of corrections up and up and up. I'm sure that all of you are aware of the tremendous expense that this has caused to the system. And for us as crime survivors, we have serious questions about whether or not mandatory sentencing really reduces crime. Do mandatory sentences really guarantee that when those people return back to their communities that they're going to be able to engage as productive members of their community? I think that that's a question that I urge you as elected leaders to review and basically urge you to take a fresh look at Measure 11. Because this particular area of sentencing causes a huge drain on our budget, and those are funds that are desperately needed for effective programs. So thank you very much for hearing my testimony, and I welcome your questions when we're done.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Victoria Hecht, and I am a WICS, Women and Community Services volunteer mentor that has been with the program for about 9 years. I am also vice president of an advertising firm here in Portland. The reason I'm here today is to put a light on two women that I have successfully helped change their lives through the WICS programs while they were incarcerated. They were both came basically drug crimes, petty theft. Both were survivors of family abuse, sexually as well as mentally as children, never was able to get any kind of foundation in their lives like we probably all have had as far as, you know, what normalcy is and how really to live your life because there was no foundation. Most women who are in prison today are in prison because they have been also on the cycle of sexual and physical abuse usually from a one-parent family who also have been incarcerated. And so the foundations of these women who are then themselves offend and go back into prison pretty much have that type of a foundation. And what WICS does is WICS provides them, while they are incarcerated, a program that deals with addiction, relationships, parenting, money management skills, interviewing techniques, and it gives them a foundation or to start building a foundation of something that they've never had before. Most of these women who have they've had their rights terminated as parents, and their children then go into the foster care system, and thus the cycle begins again and again and again. These women need to be not only held accountable, obviously, for their crimes, but while they are being warehoused and they have a lot of idle time, they do want to change their lives. And WICS provides an opportunity and an avenue to build new lives for themselves, a roadmap to success, which is showing them how to get to the different goals they would like to have, i.e. get their children back, get jobs, you know, have better skills, be better parents, be better wives, be better mothers, daughters, sisters, aunts, nieces, friends, workers in the community. WICS has been around for over 10 years, and we've had over 50 graduates. A lot of these graduates come into the prison without even having a GED. Lots of these women go out onto the community, finishing their GEDs, getting their undergraduate degrees, some getting master's, and just a few getting PhDs. Part of what makes this program work and be so successful is also the mentors, the volunteer mentors, that spend their time with these women first while they're in prison, so they get to know one another, and so they can build some level of trust, because most of these women don't know how to trust anybody, because the very people in their lives who they were supposed to trust and supposed to learn from were their parents, who either sexually abused them, physically abused them, and what I said earlier. So there is no trust. There is no basis of really trusting anybody. So they become isolated. They don't, you know, they go to the streets to care for their children by, you know, selling drugs or becoming prostitutes, because here again, they're in their survival mode. What WICS does is it gives them back their self-confidence. It gives them back their own humanity, if you will. So they are not the people. They're not. Just because they have done bad things does not mean that they're bad people. In the 9 years that I've been involved with WICS, I have seen many of these women come out with incredible self-confidence. But the one gal I've mentored for the last 4 years, her name is Connie, and she walked out of prison with a $5.08 check with nowhere to go, no family, nowhere to live, and back into the streets and back into the exact same spot that she had committed her crime. Now, that's not a real issue of or success, you know. So being a mentor, while she was in prison, we sort of laid out a roadmap of where she wants to go and what she wants to do and the goals that she wants to attain. And on $5, it's kind of hard. But she successfully became a productive member of society. She is gone. She goes around now. She got her daughter back. She helps back into the community. We speak all over the place, in churches, universities, through the capstone program at PSU. She is getting her GED. She just spoke to over 600 people to raise funds for programs like this and raised over $200,000. She was a keynote speaker last Thursday at the convention center. To say that Connie is a changed person is a completely understatement. It is. She is a remarkable woman, as is most of the people who do graduate from the WICS program, because they do come out wanting to give back, and it makes them just better human beings, and it breaks the cycle of abuse for their children to see a role model. And so those children, if they can get them back, which is very, very rare, can see that it's not just the drugs and the alcohol and all these things that have been involved in their lives before, but their mothers stop the cycle of abuse. And so I urge you to take a look at a lot of these programs and not letting these women sit idle in the penitentiaries, so they will be able to be productive citizens and taxpayers of the community. And I thank you very much for listening to my testimony. And if you have any questions, I offer whatever questions you may have.
Yeah. Chair Petridge and members of the committee, my name is Chip Shields. I'm the executive director of Better People. And Better People is a Portland-based living wage, employment, and cognitive behavioral counseling approach for adult probationers, parolees, and those under post-release supervision. Our mission is to dramatically reduce recidivism, offenders returning to crime, in Multnomah County and other areas. And we do this through a couple things. One is the cognitive behavioral therapy on the front end. Two, living wage job placement. And three, we stay in the picture for a year after that job placement. I'm also a graduate student at Portland State University, specializing in helping young offenders re-enter the community. I've been a transitional counselor for young Measure 11 offenders in McLaren Youth Correctional Facility. I am a member of the National Association of Social Workers and a member of the Oregon Criminal Justice Reform Coalition. The Better People approach was recently commended in this Citizens Crime Commission report as a proven outcome-based approach that reduces recidivism. And I'm so glad to see Victoria here because she illustrates the point that the good work being done on the inside is critical for us to be able to do our good work and reduce recidivism on the outside. I can tell you from experience that women that have gone through the WICS Life Skills Program have a much better chance of succeeding in our cognitive approach on the outside and in their job placements on the outside as well. I've seen firsthand, and I'm here to say that the prison programs and the clubs are critical, and later on I also wanted to mention a few words in support of the concept of expanding earn time. But I've seen firsthand that these programs help prepare people to be crime-free on the outside. Programs like the Seven Step Foundation, the Chicano Culture Club, Lifers Club, Pathfinders, Breaking Barriers, Turning Point. One only has to look at the life of Benny Jack, who is featured in our annual report. That's Benny right there, who now works at Gunderson Incorporated. Benny spent almost 13 years in the Oregon State Penitentiary, and the odds were pretty good that he would return there soon after his release. But Benny worked hard in prison. He participated in programs like Pathfinders and Breaking Barriers and attended Alcoholics Anonymous meetings within the walls. And these programs tilled the soil. They created a foundation for Benny to become a more pro-social human being on the outside where it counts most. Not just a better worker, but also a better person when he returned to the community, as, you know, a full 95% of all inmates will. Thanks in part to programs on the inside and better people on the outside, today Benny works at Gunderson as a prized employee. Today, he is one of Gunderson's 1,000 proud tax-paying employees instead of one of Oregon's 11,000-plus tax-sucking inmates. In closing, I'd just like to say a few words about accountability. And before the legislature, hopefully sometime this session, will be Senate Bill 16, which will create the Oregon Crime and Delinquency Policy Institute. I think that's critical as we move forward to figure out which programs work and which programs don't. From Better People's perspective, the more outcome-based decisions are made, the better. I'd also like to talk a little bit about the earn time and transitional leave. You know, I think what is critical is that we take a look at what the literature and the research shows us. And I've been familiar with Ben DeHaan's work for quite a few years. He's a PhD. I know his staff. Gary Field, his alcohol and drug person, is one of the best in the country. And I would just submit to you that if Ben and his staff say that this data is good, my tendency would be to believe them, but if you don't, what can solve that problem is by having Senate Bill 16 passed. In the future, you can have a bipartisan body take a look at the data and make some determinations. Again, the clubs and the programs prepare people in the inside to be successful on the outside. It makes our job at Better People much easier. Thank you.
I just have a question for you. I guess I'm looking at treatment programs and what we're doing and how we're doing it in the Department of Corrections, and yet our parole and post-prison supervision trend line for the state continues to go up. And now these are people who've been in the institutions, and that trend line continues to go up. We've spent money since 90s. This isn't a new issue. This is an overall trend line. We've tried to spend money on program. We've tried to do all these things. How do you reconcile the difference between what we're doing now versus what we were doing before?
Well, I heard about the data. I haven't actually taken a look at it, so I don't know if I'd feel comfortable commenting on it.
All right.
But I think that Senate Bill 16 will help solve that. I think that Ben would be the first to agree that there needs to be better data and better research so that we fund the ones that are effective.
Chair wouldn't necessarily disagree with you that we need better data collection.
But yeah,
okay.
I agree.
All right. Questions for the panel? If not, thank you all for coming. We apologize we couldn't get you on the other day.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks for having us.
We're on panel number 4. which is Crime Victims United panel. It is Howard Rockstein, Steve Dole, Janet Lovelace, and Ann Pratt. If you'd all please come forward. And the chair's going to go clean off the pen that just blew up in his hand.
I used to just do that with cigars. Now I figured out how to do it with pens.
Hide the evidence. Go ahead, Tom. You want to take it for a second?
Go ahead, please. Steve, are you going to lead off?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dole. I am president of Crime Victims United of Oregon. We're an organization that was founded in 1983 by Bob and Dee Dee Coons. We're celebrating our 20th year of existence, and I have here with me today one of our members and members of our board, and also does policy and information analysis for us, Mr. Howard Rodstein, and also two of our members, Ann Pratt and Janet Lovelace, and I'll turn it over to Howard.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Howard Rodstein. I'm a director of Crime Victims United, and I do policy analysis for it. I'm also a software developer, and I spent the last 25 years doing scientific data analysis, among other things. I'm here to testify about claims regarding earned time credits for prisoners. Last Friday, Statesman Journal quoted DOC Director Ben DeHaan as saying that studies indicate recidivism drops markedly for those who earned more than 20% reductions in their sentences. A year ago, I looked into similar claims and found them to be baseless. If DOC has new data on this, I'm unaware of it. We took the time to scrutinize and to respond to DOC's claims because experience tells us that once promulgated, such claims become part of people's entrenched beliefs, even if they are totally unfounded. That's why I felt it necessary to come to the committee today and give you some background on these claims. In May of 2002, Dr. DeHaan made statements at an interim committee hearing and later to the Salem Statesman Journal to the effect that DOC research showed that the availability of earned time reduces recidivism. After we made several requests to see the basis of this claim, DOC put us in touch with Dr. Paul Bilotti of the DOC Research Unit. I spoke at length with Dr. Bilotti and examined his charts. I found that what Dr. DeHaan characterized as research was actually a simplistic analysis of totally uncontrolled statistics culled from the DOC database. These statistics in no way justify the claim that earned time causes lower recidivism. I sincerely doubt that any statistician would make such a claim based on this data, including DOC statisticians. The problems with the study fall into two main categories. First, the data mixes disparate quantities. Earned time is mixed up with time spent in county jail, and data for behavioral, property, and violent offenders is mixed together. Second, the design of the study lacks the kind of controls that would permit a conclusion of cause and effect. There's no control group. A correlation between earned time and reduced recidivism is improperly taken to imply cause and effect. Alternative plausible explanations are not considered, and contradictory data is ignored. A more detailed critique is available in the material that was handed out. Last June, Dr. DeHaan was kind enough to meet with Crime Victims United President Steve Dole and me and to discuss the claims that he had made. He acknowledged that the DOC study was incapable of demonstrating cause and effect. I thought that the matter was settled, but after reading last Friday's Statesman Journal, it appears that I was wrong, and that's why I felt it necessary to come before the committee. Through my work with Crime Victims United, I have met many victims for whom the subject of earned time is a source of anguish. There may be valid reasons for allowing earned time, but the claim that research has shown that it causes lower recidivism is unsubstantiated. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rothstein. Who's going to be next?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again for the record, Steve Dole, Crime Victims United. First of all, I have several comments that I would like to make, but I do want to say this, that so that nobody thinks this is a sideswipe or we're coming from behind Mr. DeHaan, who I have the utmost respect for. Ben and I had a discussion about this 2 days ago over the phone, a rather spirited discussion, and he knew that we were going to testify to this point today. So I do want Mr. Chair and the committee members to know that. As you legislators would say to the bill, we support the governor's budget for the DOC. We think it's a good budget. We are not in support of the co-chair's budget for the obvious reasons, and that has to do with the granting of additional good time and transitional leave. We just do not believe you need to do that to meet the budget requirements and to balance the budget, because this is, in fact, balancing the budget on the backs of crime victims. Like I say, I have a couple of comments. This issue of 1145, we originally opposed 1145 in a special session back in 1996 on a couple bases. Number one, we believe that there would be a time that would come, and it has, that the state would not be able to fulfill its financial obligations. And we had grave concern over the types of people that were being placed in 1145 supervision. I think that 1145, though, came about as a panic over Measure 11 projected numbers, and I'd like to point this out to you, that in the voter's guide in 1994, it was projected that we would have 6,000 Measure 11 offenders in the prison system by 2001. And here we are in 2003, and about 37% of the total prison population are quote-unquote Measure 11 offenders, which is about 4,000 prisoners. So we have, depending on how you want to look at it, undershot or overshot the runway by about 2,000 prisoners. The voters in 1994, by a clear majority that I think most people who run for office would love to have, by 66, almost 67%, said, we want Measure 11. This was placed in front of the voters one more time in the year 2000, and the voters at that time, when they were asked to repeal Measure 11, voted by 74%+ to keep Measure 11. And in some polling we've done since then, specifically to the question of whether violent offenders, because remember, Measure 11 offenders are people who've done committed first and second degree felonies, the voters say by 2/3 that they do not want to give offenders who have committed first and second degree violent felonies good time. I wish we would just get off this thing and move on. Now, I'm going to tell you right up front, I'm a retributivist, and I'm proud of it. That form of criminal justice has served this country very well for 200-plus years. Do I think we have a place where we can use restorative justice? Absolutely. I'm not that dogmatic about it. I think it's a great idea for juvenile offenders who do low-level property crimes, or even for first-time property offenders who are adults. But I will tell you, I've worked with numbers, untold numbers of crime victims over the years, and I was just at a meeting from the U.S. Department of Justice a number of weeks ago where people actually were polled on this issue of restorative justice. Most of these people who were there were victims of violent crime. And I can tell you this, that by the very word, and believe me, you can take it from the horse's mouth, you cannot restore someone, their family member, when they're murdered. You cannot restore a person who's been assaulted and left with permanent brain damage or with the loss of limb or eyesight. So I think we have to be very careful about where we go with restorative justice. Is there a place for it? Absolutely. But to take over the entire system? Absolutely not. A couple other comments on the chair's budget. We oppose 18-year-olds being automatically transferred to the adult system out of the OYA, who have either been waived into the adult system or have committed Measure 11 crimes. The design of bringing Measure 11 and Senate Bill 1 together into the OYA was purposeful, that with the exception of juveniles who commit aggravated murder and murder or first-degree manslaughter, everyone else that commits those crimes, it's a juvenile at the time of the commission of the crime, if they obey the rules within OYA, they can stay in the OYA until they're 25 and never see the inside of an adult prison, and that was by design. I would end with just saying this. I think that you need to look at the numbers if you want to continue to look at this co-chair proposal. I think you need to look at how the numbers actually impact an actual crime, the offender, and the victim. And just for sake of example, if you take someone that commits a first-degree burglary, they have to have a prior of a burglary, a robbery, and a robbery two, or a combination of one of the following crimes: theft one, theft two, ag theft one, UUMV, burg one, burg two, criminal mischief, possible or possession of a stolen vehicle, or trafficking in stolen vehicles. It is not easy to get in the prison system in Oregon for doing property crimes. And I will tell you this, by the FBI and Bureau of Justice Statistics, you'll find that since 1990, since before I was involved in this, for the last 13 years, and Oregon should be ashamed of this figure, we have languished between being the fifth highest and the 14th highest in per capita property crimes, because we, unlike Measure 11, we've done nothing about the property crime problem. But let's go back to that person for a minute. Right now they have to do at least 16 months in prison, which is 80% of the sentence, before they get out. Under the chair's proposal, if they take advantage of an extra 5% and transitional, you're going to cut a 20-month sentence down to 12 months. I mean, we're going back to a system that we had in the 80s, and I might point out to you in one of the handouts that I have that you should have up there, you only need to look at this chart to see, and I'm not saying that imprisoning people is the be-all and end-all. There's a lot to this criminal justice system. It's a complex system. But you can see that during from 1960 until 1984, we built 400 new prison beds in this state, and look what the payoff was in the crime rate down below there. Look what the growth was. Now, it flattened out a little bit, and it was about to go on an upswing before the voters passed Measure 11 in 1994 and went into effect in April of 1995. Look what happened when we started imprisoning these people, and look what happened to the crime rate. I think the proof is pretty well in the pudding, and you'll see the opposite when it comes to property crimes. There was a meeting just a short time ago down in, I think it was in January, at University of Oregon on sentencing practices, and there was a professor from Berkeley, University of California, who made an interesting comment, and I'd like you to take heed of this. He says, not only are budgetary shortfalls good news, but a deliberate strategy of penal reform activists was to raise the cost of prison in a deliberate effort. That's his quote. The last thing I leave you with, and I'll turn it over to our other two members, is this. There's one other handout you have here. In 1995, the legislature referred to the people a change in Article 1, Section 15 of the Oregon Constitution. It was referred by this body at the request of Crime Victims United. It was passed by the voters of Oregon by about 65%. And it says, foundations for the principles of criminal law. Laws for the punishment of crime shall be founded on these principles: protection of society, personal responsibility, accountability for one's actions, and reformation. Let me tell you what it said before that change. It said, laws for the punishment of crime shall be founded on reformation and not vindictive justice. Well, you know what? The people said, protection of society is the most important thing. You know, when you think about it, vindictive justice is an oxymoron. You're being vindictive. You can't be just, and vice versa. So I would say this to you. In any decisions you make, you must follow the Constitution. And it doesn't say laws for the punishment of crime shall be based on what the budgetary concerns are at the moment. And I'll turn it over to Ms. Pratt and Ms. Lovelace. Thank you very much for your time.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ann Pratt. I'm a member of Crime Victims United. I would like to speak to you today about the 25% good time and an extension in the transitional leave. I'd like to share with you our own personal story about our experience with the criminal justice system. And this, on this piece of paper, is just the tip of the iceberg. I have like a 6-page timeline of events that have happened to us. But I've tried to stick to the ones that pertain to this issue. I'll fill you in with just a little bit of history. My son was killed on September 18th, 1998, by a drunk driver. And I can tell you that everything from that moment on in my world changed, right down to the tiniest speck of dust. And that day I began living my worst nightmare. The man who killed my son, Kyle William Wilson, I thought would be dealt with by the criminal justice system. Little did I know that what the criminal justice system would learn to mean to us. It means to us that it is their system. It has worked very well for Kyle William Wilson. Wilson was charged with manslaughter, 2 assault 3s, and DUI. He got lucky and drew a judge who was opposed to mandatory sentencing. In addition to that, an error occurred, and 2 of the convictions had to be thrown out at sentencing. He was convicted of criminally negligent homicide and DUI, and it netted a sentence of 30 months. He was ordered to serve those 30 months at the penitentiary. And from what I understand, he was taken to the penitentiary, processed, evaluated, sent back to Deschutes County, and he served his time at the Deschutes County Jail. And I can tell you, as a victim, that does not have the same meaning as prison. And the idea of 30 months has no meaning as far as taking 50 to 60 years of my son's life. But it was a sentence, and I expected the justice system to carry it out. Actually, we can see that Wilson manipulated the system in many ways. Yet there was a part of us that still wanted to talk to him. He had not expressed any remorse at the trial. So we did make an attempt at victor offender mediation, but it was basically about him, and it was about getting out of jail for him. And at about 13 months into Wilson's incarceration, we called to check to see how things were going with the sheriff's department. And they said, actually, we're getting him into a drug and alcohol rehabilitation program, which we had asked for many times. But the end result of that was to get him into work release and get him out into the community. This was at 13 months. He was supposed to serve 30 months. As the family of the victim, we couldn't believe this was happening. We went to work, and were able to keep him in with the help of the prosecutor in the case. And he actually, at that point, he did have the opportunity to get into the drug and alcohol treatment program, and he was kicked out for noncompliance. I remember the sheriff of the county at that point the point that we were trying to keep him in prison, in jail, telling me that within the prison system, life rarely means life, and 30 months rarely means 30 months, but for us, it did mean life without our son. Wilson was released in December of 2000 after filing an intent to sue the county, and he did escape through a loophole, got married, and resumed his life. In February of 2002, we discovered that Wilson had been driving. He was supposed to have a revocation for 8 years. We realized that DMV had not affected that revocation. It would have netted a 13 to 14 month prison sentence. We also learned that he had not been sanctioned for those. They were violations of the special conditions of his probation. I enlisted the help of the Oregon Board of Parole and the prosecutor in the case. And if it weren't for them, I'd still be fighting to have those things reinstated. We also had to get the attention of the probation officer, and that took some doing. I actually had to tell them where he was. It took 2 months to find him. She said she could not locate him, but I knew where he was. I really felt like she chose to ignore him. Wilson is now serving a 90-day sentence in a Forest Work camp. But before that, it was if community corrections, and I know it, part of it's because of the budget crunch, tried to matrix him out, work release him, or just squeeze him through the cracks. I actually felt lucky to get him in a work camp for 90 days. Wilson only served 66% of his sentence. When you total it up, it's 66%. I just want you to be aware there are other ways for inmates to get out of their incarceration. The other thing that I want you to realize is that I work with other victims, talk to lots of other victims, and we're not unique. I'm sure that I could find many victims who have gone through very similar circumstances. It just gets too hard to fight it. I think in conclusion, I really just want to say that I don't believe that any more undeserved time for good time should be extended to people who are not applying themselves or transitional leave just to save money. I don't believe this is about money. I believe it's about public safety. Thank you.
For the record, my name is Janet Lovelace, Chair Patridge, and members of the committee. Should I change places? Thank you. I'm here to tell you my personal experience, and as I have listened to previous testimony on Monday and as I've listened today, certainly I know the job here to manage the funds of Oregon is huge, but I also believe that the state of Oregon must provide public safety, and the two main things for me is public safety and education. So with that said, in June of 2000, my 12-year-old daughter was killed, struck and killed by Lee Russell Stubbs. A lot of people are very familiar with my daughter's case because of the circumstances of what this individual did after he killed my daughter. I'll make it a very long story and make it short. Mr. Stubbs has only served 27 months in a minimum security facility. He is out on post-prison supervision. He's employed in living his life. If this is at all possible for you, I would like you to just think about this question. Try to place yourself in this position. Your daughter, innocently walking home, is struck and killed by a man who's driving 57 miles per hour. Just think about that. He did not stop. He left her laying in the ditch. He drove on down the road, disposed of the empty beer cans in his vehicle, drove back by the scene, said, "Hey, did anyone see who did this?" The few people there said no. He drove on down the road to his house. Then he, the next 4 days, went through an elaborate plan to cover the crime, to escape and avoid capture, and how he would get away with it. He purchased, this is the thing that everyone always remembers, he purchased deer hair, placed it on the damaged vehicle, and tried to get away with it. Would you feel satisfied with the sentence of 27 months of prison? He left your child in a ditch. He showed no compassion, no sorrow for the crime, for the loss of life he took. He planned only how to cover his crime. Would you feel justice was served? These are the facts. Your daughter is dead. The individual who caused her death is now free to live his life after having served just over 2 years in prison. Does that make any sense? How do you feel? The fact that I'm here to speak to you about such an outrageous proposal as to increase the earn time for offenders like Stubbs boils my blood. For the victims and the victims' family, the only legal avenue we have, the only way that we are going to feel any sense of justice, any sense of vindication, is the use of the criminal justice system. But when the system seems to conveniently forget its true purpose, which is it was established to keep law and order in society, to punish those individuals who choose to break the laws, and therefore, by doing that, they will protect the law-abiding citizens. Allowing criminals additional earn time off their sentence is pro-criminal and anti-victim. I also believe that the dollars that are proposed to be saved by increasing the earn time are just dollars that will be traded, shifted. They'll be shifted from the prison budget system onto law enforcement, district attorney's offices, who will be, as we're all very well aware of, vast majority of these people are back in trouble again, repeat offenders. Don't increase earn time to any higher level, please. 20% to me is already outrageous. At the time my daughter was killed, of course, you don't know. You don't know anything about law. You don't know anything about anything. We were told 40 months. He served 27 months. It's a hard concept to grasp when you're in shock and grief and indescribable pain. But I do believe that it is the duty of the state of Oregon to first provide public safety for the protection of all citizens, and second, to fund education. All other needs, wishes, dreams, whatever you want to call it, come only and after those two priorities are met. As you struggle with making budget-cutting decisions over the next couple of weeks, what cuts to make, what programs to eliminate, think about the victims of crime. Knowing that Stubbs served some prison time, some, is little consolation in comparison to my lifelong loss of my daughter. But it is at least some justice. don't take that away from victims. It is all we have. If we're going to stay legal about this, that's what we have. We have the system to punish those who commit the crimes, who choose to have the behavior that they do. One last thing, just as you do go through very, very tough decisions, think about how you would feel if your child's room was empty. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Mr. Chair, if I may, one last comment, and I'm sorry I forgot this in my testimony.
Going to have to be real short.
I will make it very short.
We've got to do Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision.
I promise I will make this very brief. I think one of the things that if you choose to go this route and not adopt the governor's budget, let's be honest with the system and take sentencing guidelines and move the dispositional line up and just shorten the sentences up front and not mess around with the good time, because once you shorten the good time, we're never going to see it back. And if you follow this path, which we hope you don't, we hope you adopt the governor's budget, but if you follow this path, then do it with a sunset clause so those sentences can come back when the economy returns.
Thank you, Steve.
Yep.
Thank you all. I know it's tough. I'm gonna let Karen Nibbler from League of Women Voters come testify. Is Peter here? Okay, Peter. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you for the opportunity to come and having public hearings. I'm Karen Nibbler, representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon. And the League is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization that encourages informed citizen participation in government and provides voter education materials and activities. We also advocate on some issues, and that's the reason we're here. League of Women Voters of Oregon was originally opposed to Measure 11, and that's one of the things that we want to follow up on. We actually encouraged the review of the mandatory sentencing under Measure 11. What we were in favor of originally was the sentencing guidelines. We thought it was reasonable, and in order to reduce the disparity in sentencing. And we also liked the judges were responsible for determining the length of the sentences and that the judges had discretion. Under the current system, the district attorneys have the discretion, and we hire them to be prosecutors, and we hire the judges to have discretion. And we also support the continuation of the parole board, and I understand they're going to be testifying today. Our concern is that mandatory sentences don't take into account past history. And in most cases, the people that are sentenced under this, under Measure 11, usually do have the history. And they usually have all the extenuating circumstances, and they deserve that sentence. But occasionally there are people who don't have the history, and there are some mitigating factors that aren't taken into consideration. And so we think that sometimes it's used when it shouldn't be, and lesser sentences should be applied. One of the things we're in favor of are any of the second look options, the earned time credits, transitional leaves, any ways to reduce the prison populations. And we think that if they are doing well and it's recommended that they be released early, that everyone benefits from that. The offender benefits, of course, but also the whole system does in terms of cost. And if they are reformed and come out with a decent attitude, they could be returning as decent citizens. And what you're looking at is the outcome and what people are coming out of the prisons, what condition they're in when they come out. Also, some of these people do support their families. and you want them to be doing that. And in some cases, I think Measure 11 may be punishing the taxpayer even as much as they're punishing the offender. One of the things we recommend is that a financial impact statement be attached to any referral to the voters on mandatory sentences, because when it was originally referred to the voters, there was not an impact statement, and I think people don't realize how much Measure 11 is costing them. And if you went back and with another measure and put the financial impact on it, that may not be passed, probably, especially not in this climate. One of the things we also are supportive of are the programs within the prisons, alcohol and drug especially. That's something that I think we need to work on, and most of the people in the prisons have this problem. And they aren't going to get out of the criminal system unless they break those drug habits. We also support the community prevention and treatment programs. There's a high demand for outpatient and residential alcohol and drug treatment for adult offenders. And we just started the drug courts, and we don't have the alcohol and drug treatment options in the community to support the drug courts. I mean, if there's not a program to refer them to, you can't, you know, require that they do it. So we're concerned about that. Also, alcohol and drug treatment can keep people from getting into the system originally. Also, we have a major concern about juveniles coming into the adult system and into the adult correctional facilities. And I personally am a retired juvenile court counselor, so I've had cases of kids who were sentenced under Measure 11. And originally, they are committed to the Department of Corrections, and they're usually placed into McLaren or one of the juvenile facilities. They're usually held at McLaren. However, McLaren can transfer them, as I'm sure you're aware. They can transfer them to the adult facilities if they're assaultive or non-compliant with program. And I've been listening in on these hearings and heard that 33 a month are being transferred into the adult correctional facilities. And to me, that's a pretty high number per year, and it's also going to put some additional pressure on the adult system to have that many juveniles come in. And I would like to see them stay at the McLaren or the juvenile facilities if they can. I mean, I liked what the crime victims people were saying. Because these, I mean, they're there between like age 16 and 25. Now, those are really formative years for most young people. And most young people are in high school and college. And these kids are going to adult correctional facilities where they're going to be even better educated in criminal methodology. So I think, you know, that's not a good system. And I understand why Measure 11 came into effect. I mean, there were cases where juveniles were doing murders and having guns. I mean, and there are some of them who deserve those sentences and who should be there. But there are some others who were not, who could have been left in the juvenile system or who could be left in juvenile institutions. So our major point is that we'd encourage the legislature to take a second look at the mandatory sentences for youth offenders and allow more discretion by judges or second look hearings. There's also a national trend to reconsider adult convictions of juveniles, saying that they don't understand all of their rights at the time that they're going through these hearings and prosecutions. So there's some cases which require longer sentences, such as murder, but in many cases, the youth offender can be sentenced in the juvenile system and serve at least 5 years. And we encourage you to look at that. Currently we're concerned about the capacity of the juvenile systems also, since they have cut 250 cases and there's no space there. One of the other things we noticed in the budget was that There were cuts to the community programs so that the shelter care and foster care and residential treatment options for juveniles on the community level
are lower. This is the corrections budget, though.
Yeah. But, I mean, this
is...
Okay, I'm looking at the bigger picture and how all this is impacting. And if you don't have residential treatment options, foster care, and shelter care at the community level, what's going to happen is they're going to commit those kids to the institution. So it just pushes everybody up. There's going to be more pressure for the McLaren and OYA system to push those kids out and push them into the Department of Corrections. That's the reason I brought that up. Okay. The other thing is the alcohol and drug treatment, and that's something that you have to do all the way through the system, too. And I did drug and alcohol groups with kids. They start when they're 12. So you have to start working on them when they're 12 so they don't get further into the juvenile system. The kids that I saw that went into the adult system had drug and alcohol problems. So you have to work on them in the juvenile system so they don't go into the adult system with drug and alcohol. So I think drug and alcohol treatment is major all the way through. So, thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Senator George.
I'm looking at the Oregon Constitution, Article 1, Section 15, and I'm looking at this chart that shows Measure 11. What happened to violent crimes following the passage of Measure 11? How do you justify your thoughts relative to what is the intent of the Constitution and what the result was of Measure 11?
I'm not sure where you got that chart
I've
from.
Seen that for years, and I think that reflects the percentage of reported violent crimes per 100,000 residents.
And is that juveniles?
This is all violent crimes. And it shows Measure 11 right there. Mm-hmm. The drop that occurred.
Well, it's obviously a disincentive if they know there's going to be a longer sentence than they're likely to. And also, the same goes for having any consequences all the way along. I mean, there has to be a detention facility so that kids went to detention. There has to be a jail so that people go to jail. I mean, there has to be just consequences all the way along.
We're not making decisions on Measure 11 here right now. We're trying to deal with the budget within the confines
but
of
it.
Current law, we understand that it impacts it, but if we have a Measure 11 bill down here, we'll invite everyone to jump on. Hold on, Representative Butler had a question.
And I think, Mr. Chair, that my question may be better answered because it deals with two sets of conflicting testimony relative to the financial impact that was originally portrayed on Measure 11, Measure 4, and some of the other enactments, constitutional enactments. My concern is this, the expression is that we've heard earlier that the estimated numbers of Measure 11 criminals would be about 50% higher than what it is actually within our system. And one of the things that Ms. Nibbler has in her testimony, at the time the voters approved these measures, the financial impact was not accurately projected. The voters may not continue to support mandatory sentences if the cost to taxpayers is known. I wonder if I might get that from the Department of Corrections as to, you know, how wildly that was off. And it sounds like, if anything, it was may have been skewed the other way as opposed. Anyway, if I could get that information.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have a very brief testimony. We have heard from sheriffs, lots of county people and whatever, but I'm happy to take you, Commissioner Hyde, very briefly. We do have the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, so when it is 20 minutes till, I'm going to cut you off, and we will roll in here. But I did want to extend that. We called you early, but you guys were obviously somewhere else. So.
This is me, Mr. Chair. Keep a bad company, and I apologize.
Wow. You hang out with the riffraff, and we worry about you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tony Hyde, Commissioner from Columbia County, and more importantly, President of the Association of Oregon Counties. I just want to reiterate what's been said on behalf of the counties and local government. First of all, as you well know, property tax system was not designed to complement or support Senate Bill 1145. That's why it was a contractual relationship in the first place in its inception. We just had a conversation with Commissioner Bryant, who's the chair of Washington County. As you know, three counties have already submitted letters to opt out. They are drafting a letter as of their staff meeting last Friday, to opt out as well in Washington County. And that's a very significant county indeed. I want to remind you again that our objective is beyond cutting funds. The objective is criminal justice. And having the counties opt out is not going to get us there. We as an association do not particularly want to opt out of this 1145 agreement. We think it's a good system and it's working well, but we're simply getting to the point where we're below the capabilities of delivering the system as mandated by Senate Bill 1145. That's a very important piece. The second one is that considering the option of reducing the workload by adjusting sentence guidelines, it simply doesn't work for us. Typically, those offenders that would be out on the street are considered the smaller offenders are the ones that are going to end up escalating. And they're also the ones that are the most troublesome to the local governments and our constituents throughout the state. So it simply, in terms of criminal justice, it won't help the bottom line, which is keep our citizens safe. So that's the end of my very brief testimony.
Commissioner Hyde, you weren't here earlier, and while both of you were here when the Marion County people were here, I think you were here yesterday or day before,
Monday.
We talked about 1145 and the money. I'm highly concerned, and I'd appreciate it if AOC would work with the department on what we can do. If you look at Columbia County's trend line for recidivism, your line just ticks off like a rocket. You were way below beforehand, and it has taken off like gangbusters.
Mm-hmm.
I'm concerned, and I need the counties to work with DOC, and we'll probably put together some kind of little work group to figure out what we're going to do, but I'm not willing to have the... I wasn't a supporter of 1145, even though I wasn't in the legislature. I happened to be a DA when it went through. But I am highly, highly concerned about how we're going to hold counties accountable and what the state involvement is. And, coming from local government, I'm a believer in local government. By the same time, I want to figure out, working with the counties, how we can put some accountability onto these programs so that when we see trend lines going like this, what's the appropriate state intervention? So I just commence that to you
and
the counties, and I would appreciate it if you could send that message back, and I plan on convening some kind of little task force group to work on
absolutely
how we're going to deal with this, because it's going to have to be statutory.
I'd be happy to do that.
Okay, thanks.
All
right, at this point in time, we're going to hear the public hearing from the Board of Parole and Post-Prison we'll close this public testimony on 5509, Department of Corrections. We're going to open public testimony on House Bill 5043. House Bill 5043 is parole and post-prison supervision. I'm trying to figure out how we want to do this from the department's vantage point. We can hear from Doug at some later point in time. Your public testimony people, we could bring Ben back at some point in time too, probably. Steve, so who are your public people? Richard Sly and Steve Dole, who are here, and Diane, you're here, and we can get you when we need you too. So I'm trying to see, do you want to put Steve and Richard on while they're here and then go into your presentation? That work for
yep,
you?
That's fine.
Okay, then let's go ahead and do that. So Ben, Mr. Sly, and Steve, you want to come forward? Is Mr. Sly here? Ben, you want to go ahead?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Benjamin Dehan. I'm the interim director of the Oregon Department of Corrections, and it's a great relief to me not to be having to talk about the Department of Corrections, but rather another agency. I'm only going to take a moment or two, and what I'd like to do today is really emphasize how important the Department of Corrections believes that the Board of Parole and Post prison supervision is to the criminal justice system. We have enjoyed a very strong partnership during my 8 years with the Department of Corrections. The board has been very, very supportive of our internal changes that we've wanted to make in the Oregon accountability model. They've worked a great deal in improving release planning, and we are very appreciative of that. They've gone out of their way to train our DOC counselors to improve the releasing, our releasing capabilities, and they've been very good problem solvers related to community corrections. So very quickly, I just wanted to point to those things, and I'll just turn it over to the next witness. Thank you.
Thank you. Steve, you want to go ahead?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Steve Dole, Crime Victims United of Oregon. We are in support of the bill. We are in support of the budget. We are in support of the parole board. I have to say this, that while you take the opportunity to criticize, I think it also leaves you with the responsibility to give praise. And I just want to say that Diane Ray, the chair of the parole board, and her the other parole board members, Mr. Washington and Ms. Hanner, I believe it is, do a terrific job. On a scale of 1 to 10, I would have to say they're at 11 in the assistance that they give to victims. Several things that are important. Upon request, the board provides written notification to crime victims within 30 days before the release of inmates from prisons throughout the state. And I think this is important. I know that you're aware of the VINE system, but I will tell you this: a computerized phone call when there is the event of a release does not do the job. The having this personal touch through a letter and a real person on the other end of the phone line telling the victim that there's about to be a release is of utmost importance, because besides the crime, when you set aside the crime, sometimes to some victims that release event is more traumatic than the trial itself. So I want to point out that, and I would hate to see that be taken away, and I hope that you continue that. The board provides copies of orders of supervision to crime victims and others, and that allows victims to have a written order of the conditions of release and what that offender has to adhere to. And you heard from Ms. Pratt by having those conditions handy that she was able to follow up on what happened with her offender, and he was, because he was violating the law. The board invites and considers input from victims regarding conditions of release. We just had a member whose son was murdered 10 years ago and is working with Diane Ray around conditions of release, because this particular offender has made comments to his family members and, I believe, prisoners, don't quote me on that, fellow inmates, that he is seeking revenge. The board invites and considers input from victims at board hearings when they're determining whether to grant parole release. I can tell you that myself and Mr. Rodstein attended one of these hearings about, I want to say, 6 to 8 months ago with a state policeman. Now, this is a guy who was almost a murder victim. He was shot in Roseburg back in the 80s. And, this is a guy that's been involved in the criminal justice system and had all kinds of trepidation and anxiety about going to this hearing. And there were some other issues at hand, but I can tell you that Diane Ray put him at ease, treated him with respect, and in the end game, this prisoner was held for 2 more years. Last but not least, the parole board is a regular and reliable source of information to crime victims about a host of events throughout their incarceration and leading up to their release, and it provides important public education and reduces some of the frustration that victims suffer within the criminal justice system. So I would ask your endorsement and support of this critical piece of the system. And again, I commend Chair Ray for her work. She's a great lady.
Thank you, Steve. Mr. Slott.
Good afternoon, Chair Patridge. I have a letter, if I might. Can I give it to this gentleman?
just be careful out there.
Okay.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Patridge and members of the committee. My name is Richard Sly, and I come from the picturesque county of Yamhill, where Senator George watches over our work. He also raises filberts. Were you aware of that?
Yes, we were.
Mm-hmm.
He hasn't brought any to the committee yet, but
I think he ships them just about everywhere else. Members of the committee, I'm here representing the spokesperson for the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors, and I know that you recall you heard from us on Monday regarding community corrections funding. Today we want to express to you our solid support for the Oregon Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. I'll make my remarks brief, but I think the points that I want to make for you, that the board is really, I think, the governor's representative when it comes to administering really tough and critical decisions related to prisoners in our institutions. I've been a practitioner in the community corrections business for over 20 years, and I think since the time when I came into the system working at McLaren, when some of the students, there was a law change then, were status offenders. If you were a bad boy and ran away and such, you could be sent to McLaren. The legislature changed that. And I think over the years, the legislature has attended to the business of classifying offenders in a way where the folks that can be managed in the community are managed there. It's less expensive. The folks that really need to be locked up in the prisons, I think that's where they're at. The greatest share of people that are in our penitentiary system are the most dangerous offenders, person-to-person offenders. And I'm pleased that the Board of Parole in Oregon is very responsive on an operational basis when it comes to questions. As a parole officer, a number of times it was very common for us to be able to call directly and speak to someone who had the important position that Diane Ray does, to ask questions on formalities and technicalities. As an administrator, I'm pleased to tell you that Diane attends virtually all of the community corrections directors meetings that are held every other month throughout the state. She comes with new information, training, suggestions, ways of doing things better, and I think this is really important, hence our support for the Board of Parole. Just for the numbers, it's kind of awesome. When you look at the column that the Department of Corrections keeps in its research and development section for post-prison supervision and parole, there are about 11,000 some offenders that are on that status in the community. Again, those folks, by reason of the way that the system has evolved, are the most serious and most dangerous. We have a fellow right now, for example, that the board has dealt with who was an old parole case. He grabbed a little girl who was 10 years old off a schoolyard in Newburgh with the intent of committing a sexual assault. He had a previous conviction for raping a hitchhiker in Nevada. He came out of the institution and didn't do very well. When he didn't do very well, this information was reported to the board. And I can tell you one of the very pleasing things about the board is the swift and accountable reactions that we've received. This particular individual, like some other examples you've heard, went back to the institution for a two-year stay. So the board does have discretion to make those kind of decisions. There's some interesting research done by a fellow at the University of British Columbia by the name of Robert Hare. He has sorted out information about individuals in the correctional system that have personality problems that lend themselves to criminal conduct. He says that about 70% of all of the prison inmates have an antisocial personality disorder. That means they're always getting into trouble. About 15% of that group, and if you apply those numbers to Oregon, are psychopaths, individuals that are very likely to commit new criminal activity. And those are the individuals I think that the board exercises its muscle in being able to hold in the prison. I won't comment on the victim notification because I think people with certainly more experience than I have commented about that. But the board has, way before the Vine system, given a lot of importance and priority to notifying people. And Mr. Dole spoke to that issue. And I would tell you from our experience that that's very true.
In the system, we received notification if a police officer has been a victim of an offender who has made threats and gone to prison. The board is very conscientious about notifying those departments about that type of information. So I offer the letter and our support for the budget for the Board of Parole. It's an independent agency. I think it deserves your full support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fly. I did have a question for you on, I'm trying to ask community corrections directors, as you've probably heard over the course.
Certainly.
Your Yamhill County seems to be doing
good numbers.
Looks like it has very good numbers on parole and post-prison supervision as opposed to some of your compatriots who may be out there in the field. Can you tell it? But your parole and post-prison supervision numbers are not as dramatic, obviously, as your probation numbers. You guys seem to be doing very, very well with probation and staying above the state and keeping below the state average to a great degree on the post-prison supervision. Mm-hmm. How have you managed that in your community? Has that?
Well, we have the good fortune. I was present when the folks from Marion County testified. One of the advantages that we've had is when you passed in 1995 the Senate Bill 1145, we sort of value-added our effort. We joined up with Polk County. We were the ownership county. They were the participating county. And we added 104 beds to our facility, 64 of those beds paid for by dollars from the 1145 grant. We took the opportunity when the construction group was there to add another 33 beds, and we borrowed money from the Solid Waste Fund and turned around and rented those beds back to other counties that hadn't quite gotten ahead of the curve. And so we were able to retire that debt. You actually hold a 20-year lease till 2016 on that facility. So why am I talking about jails when you're asking about trends? The answer to that is we have the ability to sanction people. And in a small rural county, it's kind of like talking to the parole board. We can get a hold of people pretty quickly when they give us samples for dirty urines and such. We can put them in jail and do an administrative sanction, which is the business of community corrections, thanks to Senate Bill 139, I think, in 1993. Which enables us to pretty handily take care of those folks. I think that's part of the reason.
So the large counties maybe haven't invested as much in their ability to sanction previously. Is that a fair representation?
That might be it. They have a different style of practice because of the magnitude of the numbers. And we do some preemptive things, which I think is part of the beauty of the community corrections, and this would be my plug. We provide supervision and a systems-wide approach for domestic violence offenders not funded by the state. That's a misdemeanor. And the DUI offender, because we're located between the metro area and the coast, or, if you choose, between the metro area and the casino. A lot of traffic, and some of that traffic is driving under the influence. And so the police, the district attorney, the 911 responders, treatment programs, community corrections, all pay attention and put our resources that are provided by the county into that effort.
Okay, thank you.
That's why I was outside the room. I was speaking to these two fine ladies about coming up to McMinnville to speak at our DUI impact panel.
Thank you, Mr. Sly.
Certainly.
Mr. Chair, one...
Representative Hanson, for the record.
I may be... completely off the base, but one of the things I remember from when 1145 passed, Yamhill County had one of the lowest cost per day facilities, and which I'm sure is an indication of fine management that was happening. But I'm wondering if, and obviously Multnomah County had the absolute highest cost by a huge amount. But I'm wondering if there would be any correlation in terms of some of the successes. Because if you had a low cost environment, there was a potential even to make money off of 1145 or come a lot closer to break even. Whereas the higher cost counties required more local funds to supplement it. And I'm just wondering if maybe some of the variations that we're seeing might be able to be tracked back to dollars and cost of programs that way. And I don't know how relevant that is, but I'm wondering if we're looking for things that may cause some variations. Certainly, if you've got the empty jail bed, you're probably in a better position to be able to make the programs effective.
Okay. Senator George?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I had two people laugh at our solid waste fund. I was on the budget committee in Yamhill County when we did that. But nobody laughs when they come down there and they see how efficient that whole operation is, and I think that's the key. If you don't waste the money, just get in the place and build. You have money to run programs that seem to bring numbers down.
Thank you, Senator George.
No.
No, I'm just kidding.
The House is convening at 3 o'clock today, so...
We're going to recess the committee
so we can catch up with the volume of bills our Senate colleagues are sending us. That we are adjourned on House Bill 5043.
Is that the volume of the